And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Hello, and welcome to another Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. In this episode, we'll be looking at Volume 9, Issue 4, The First Punic War. To discuss the topic, I'm joined by Joshua Browers, Murray Darm, Lindsay Powell, Mark McCaffrey, and Mark DeSantis. So this would be the longest uninterrupted war in antiquity between Rome and Carthage. Up until this point, Rome has been focused on the Italian peninsula, but when the Mamertines on Sicily asked for help, they assisted. Why? The Romans had not yet ventured overseas, and they knew it might bring them into conflict with Carthage.
Sicily was already quite a bit of a disaster area, of course, in the 5th to 4th centuries BC, with the Greeks and the Carthaginians fighting it out amongst themselves and the native people getting involved as well. And then Pyrrhus eventually being invited over to southern Italy and then going to Sicily to try and get things done there. And then the Romans got involved. And that basically, as far as I see it, is sort of the whole catalyst for how everything spiraled out of control eventually.
It also shows up the Carthaginian weaknesses in Sicily at that time, when you've got Pyrrhus going over there and showing that you can actually turf out the Carthaginians and get the locals onto your side, although, you know, Pyrrhus isn't as successful and he eventually leaves and the Carthaginians retake their positions. I think it sort of exposes for the Romans that there's a potential there that they could jump upon if they're, you know, if they seize the opportunity.
Yeah, I think also a pretext to get involved at little risk and then mission creep and, you know, acquiring an empire.
So that was on their list. You know, it's one of those things. Why do they go, you know, why cross the seas? They're a land-based, you know, they could have just well gone north, kept on the land, jumping the water. I mean, admittedly, it's not the largest body of water to cross. They're not a naval nation. You know, you're going against a naval nation is who you're bumping into.
My old professor of Mediterranean archaeology always said that the Romans were very afraid of their neighbors, usually, and they always thought that you would live much more happily if you had pacified your neighbors. So that's why they usually tried and ended up conquering surrounding areas. And of course, as soon as you've pacified your neighbors, then there's your neighbors' neighbors who are not pacified and might pose a risk at some point in the future. And this, coupled with the high-ranking Roman male proclivity to enlarging your own status and prestige by excelling in warfare, those two combined ensured that the Romans sort of spread out like an ink blot, first across the Italian peninsula, and then finally also they spilled over that. This drive on the one hand to excel militarily and build prestige, and on the other hand to make sure that, you know, the country is safe and secure from any would-be aggressors. And this sort of escalates, and this is what eventually forges the Roman Empire, which is... Mm. Not something that was done intentionally. I don't think there was no big idea to found this large empire, but it just sort of happened.
Particularly with southern Italy at that time, I mean, that's why they go south rather than north. You've got so much sort of the coming and goings of southern Italy, both, you know, you can look at that time and also after the Romans as well. It's a melting pot of, you know, different conflicts starting between different individuals. So for the Romans, it's a weak front that they really need to secure in order to make sure that what they've actually established in central Italy is maintained and safe.
There'll always be a neighbour needing pacifying if you're going to do that inkblot spread. And again, you know, that's one of the arguments Julius Caesar uses, is that, you know, we can't have neighbours like this on our northern border, whether you believe him or not, but it sort of sticks with that theory. So, and I think also I suppose in a way it was low risk. You know, it wasn't on their doorstep as such. So if it went wrong, they could easily abandon the Mamertines if they needed to.
They're not really a proper nation, really, the Mamertines. I mean, they haven't established themselves here. You're not going to offend anybody long-term because, you know, they're just an experimental group that you can chuck here and there.
It's almost like a proxy war, though, insofar as you're not necessarily head-on. You're fighting over a third-party territory when you're lots of the wrestling goes on in Sicily, which is not necessarily either side's home base.
It's also getting them involved in... It's like a testing war to actually get involved later on with the Hellenistic states, successor states. I mean, it's, you know, Pyrrhus has sort of come over and exposed them to that sort of side of the Mediterranean warfare. And for them, it's, you know, that's been, you know, they've seen he's sort of attempted to bring to the West. And they're possibly, maybe that's giving them the idea of, you know, we can do something similar to what we've sort of, we're hearing about in the East. Maybe.
So if we look at the two sides, how did Rome and Carthage compare?
It depends on what you think of the Roman Navy. Do you believe that the Roman Navy was so non-prepared?
Polybius said that the reason that the Romans decided to build the Navy, a big Navy, in the first place was that while the Romans were dominant on land, they couldn't keep coastal Sicilian cities in line because the Carthaginian fleet would appear offshore and scare them back into Carthaginian orbit. And that's when they decided they actually had to build a fleet to wrest control of the sea away from the Carthaginians.
But already you've got the treaties going on long before that, and that sort of says that the Romans are actually... They've got some sort of naval presence that then the Carthaginians are responding to. So is it a response by the Romans in the first place, or is it that there's something going on before where we are aware of it? Is it Polybius and other authors basically trying to paint a romantic picture of the Romans coming out of nowhere with their navy?
Same story with Roman cavalry. You know, there's always been that the Romans were weak in cavalry until... they defeat Carthage and take Carthaginian cavalry, and therefore look, we're strong. And I mean, it's a sort of like a similar pattern that the patterning that seems to be occurring with the Roman military is that they're an infantry based system, and therefore anything that's not infantry based is adopted and adapted from anywhere else. And you know, there've been arguments recently about that Roman cavalry always gets a bad rap, but isn't. And wasn't as bad as it's always been made out to be, and similarly, like with the stories of the adoption of a Roman navy in the manner that we're told it gets made, they would have no expertise, they would have no one who knew what to do with ships, let alone manning them. All of a sudden, so all of those sorts of questions sit unanswered with the whole idea of copying a wrecked ship and making your own navy. So they must have had some kind of expertise of their own to start with, that yes, they amazingly quickly built that into a military force, but it can't have been non-existent.
Pretty inconsistent in terms of which ships are using throughout the Punic Wars. Are they using allied ships and then they are using Roman ships, but the allied ships seem to disappear for a time. And then they're back with allied ships, and the number of ships from either allies or being built by allies or being built by the Romans, it's never a consistent picture throughout that period. Mm.
So they built this huge fleet from nothing, didn't they, in, what is it, 4 years or something ridiculous? Mm-hmm. And it's a huge fleet.
60 days is supposedly, I think Polybius says, that they could actually, from cutting the timber to actually getting the ship floated, it was 60 days.
I think the speed of the building of the fleet is very reasonable, considering that the Romans copied a Carthaginian quinquereme that wrecked itself ashore. The Carthaginians themselves used a kit-building method, that the parts were all standardized. Mm. And apparently they found that the Marsala wreck, where there were actually markings which showed exactly where each piece was supposed to go. I think that if you had these pieces pre-cut according to some original form, you could stockpile it and put them together, almost like an IKEA flat pack, all right? And could be done very quickly. We don't have information on how the Romans actually built their ships. There's no attestation as this is what was done. Mm. But the Venetians in the 16th century, in their arsenale, they could put together galleys very rapidly using the same methods. It was mass production with interchangeable parts. And it strikes me as being that the Carthaginians and the Romans had hit upon this method of building beforehand. And if every ship is identical, then, or at least close to identical as might exist in a pre-industrial civilization, it's the collecting of the resources that probably took the most time. Once you had the pieces all there, it was a matter of hammering them together and getting them fitted out.
And there was no shortage of manpower, of course, because you could always use slaves.
But just having the ships is one thing. You need people to crew them, and you're crewing ships and naval and navigation, everything else that goes with it, is not something that's an overnight thing that you can just pick up from nowhere.
But one of the, I think, I'm just trying to think of which one it was I've got here. Steinbe, that's who it is, I think, mentions about if you've got, say, a trireme or a quinquireme, then in terms of every back of the oars, you only really need one trained, very well-trained oarsman coordinating a team to actually get the call actually going. So in terms of the whole entire crew, you're only going to need, one-third or one-fifth of your crew really actually being the expertise really being there, and then the others can be, slapdash training.
If a predominantly land-based military comes across, and decides to go into naval warfare, do they bring anything new to the table?
I think the Romans adopted tactics where, as much as possible, they tried to turn sea fights into land fights. They installed the Corvus boarding bridge on the decks of their ships. They refused to engage in fancy maneuvering. They just went straight at the Carthaginians, rammed them however they could, prow to prow, dropped the Corvus down on their decks, and then had their Marines rush across and fight boarding actions. It was a remarkably effective tactic. The Carthaginians, though they had a much, much richer maritime tradition than the Romans did, and more competent seamen, in almost all of the battles, the Romans turned out to be the victor. There were a handful of times where the Carthaginians had the edge. When I say a handful, maybe two times. But all of the big battles went Rome's way.
But again, this possibly slows down the ships with the Corvus and also having the extra troops on board. Right. It's also not exactly a new tactic, because I think Thucydides actually mentioned some use of not a Corvus as such, but a boarding bridge, creating land battles at sea, in his own words. So it seems to be, and also the Romans then get rid of it fairly quickly. I mean, it doesn't get mentioned in every battle in the Punic Wars. It just seems to disappear very quickly. Whether this is really an accurate sort of saying the Romans are bringing land expertise to the sea, or whether we're just, it's our sources. Our problem with our sources is they sort of fixate on one thing at a certain time, and how that's been interpreted ever since maybe has given a bad reputation to the Romans and what should be actually a better naval expertise. And they did actually.
I mean, perhaps the difference that they bring is the efficiency that they have in their land organization is what they bring to perhaps not only making the ships, if they were made in kit set form, that kind of system is amazingly efficient when they adopt it quickly, but also that idea of how do we nullify the fact that we don't have such a vast amount of sea expertise, and therefore do one thing and do one thing well, and therefore perhaps catch the Carthaginians off off balance in the sense that they're not going to do anything other than fight land battles at sea by making the sort of one big tactic that they know that they can excel at because they have such good land forces. So their Marines simply are doing what they know they can do well, and they give them a position and a situation where they can. So perhaps, you know, perhaps the Corvus or land bridges had fallen out of use through naval warfare becoming about seamanship and maneuvering, and the Romans sort of reintroduce a very blunt and brutal tactic.
We're not talking a little gangplank, though, are we? It's not a little gangplank that just gets thrown across. We're talking a huge structure that...
It's on a pivot and attached to the mast, usually, and then dropped down and has a grapple on the end of it to actually break through the deck. So, no.
Interestingly, it must have been somewhat successful because Agrippa reintroduced it for the war against Sextus Pompeius in 36, 37. So it must have worked. Agrippa wasn't one to take stupid inventions. He liked good inventions.
I think I've read something as well, whether it was effective or not in terms of if you had ships of different sizes, how effective would it be in terms of would you have to have ships of same levels to actually drop it down, or if you're going small against big, does it become useless?
Well, that's very interesting because Sextus Pompeius had Liburnians, whereas Agrippa had very large, I think, five deckers. So that would.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's exactly where it would be successful. Yeah, you'd actually get leverage. You'd get sort of a height advantage.
Its origin is complicated and mysterious. Its use is not especially well defined. I mean, we just know that it's dropped down onto the deck of an enemy ship, and somehow it works. And it disappears from mention in Polybius after its use at Ecnomus, and we don't hear of it again from him. And why the Romans don't seem to have used it after that, we don't know. There's a suggestion that it created a top heaviness to their ships that caused massive losses in storms, and that's why it was removed. I'm not entirely convinced that the Corvus was such an impediment that they would have gotten rid of it for that reason. But the fact is we don't hear about it after 256 BC. And one of the big battles that the Romans actually did lose to the Carthaginians, the Battle of Drepana in 249, seems that the Romans did not have the Corvus. They were pretty much defenseless against and trapped up against the shoreline, and it stands to reason that they lacked that boarding bridge, which had given them success in all earlier battles.
Can I just ask a question? Because it's just jumped into my mind here. In terms of the Corvus, I said a moment ago, to my line of thinking, I'm aware that it's pulled up onto the mast itself, and that to then get the levy and then drop. But mostly you get triremes and the like taking their mast down and leaving them on the land or something during battles.
I've thought about the question of what exactly was the pole that the Corvus is said to have pivoted around. And Polybius's description is bare bones. It's a 24-foot high pole with a 36-foot long boarding bridge placed at the bow of a Roman quinquiremes. To my mind, the most parsimonious answer is that the boarding bridge was attached to the bow mast at the bow of the ship. It's difficult to know. He does not say this. The one thing we do know is that there was a pulley on the top of the pole. Some Romans would pull up on the boarding bridge and pivot it around the pole and then drop it down. Again, it's a mysterious device. I think the most efficient thing that they would have done is to use the bow mast for it. And yes, masts were taken down very easily. The mainmast and the bowmast before combat strikes me as being is that they could easily have simply kept the bowmast in place and then use that in battle. That's my theory.
But is it becoming too cumbersome later on, and then that's maybe why the corpus disappears?
That, again, is a very good question, and there isn't really a good answer to that. My belief is that if they were using a mast or simply had put some other pole onto their ships, I don't see why they could not have taken it down when battle was not in the offing. And if they could have taken it down relatively quickly and easily, why would they have been traveling with it and run into these storms when they were not on their way to fight the Carthaginians? It seems that they probably would have taken it down. My belief is that they got rid of the Corvus because it was either simply not necessary anymore, they had other means to board, or the Carthaginians perhaps had developed some sort of countermeasure finally, although that raises the question is why is the Carthaginians took years to find some sort of answer to the Corvus. It was a battle-winning weapon that changed the course of the war that then gets no mention after 256.
Is it curious that the Carthaginians never copied it?
The Carthaginians, as in more or less put forward in all sources, seems to have been more about maneuver tactics, that is, using the trireme and the ram of the trireme to attack an enemy ship, hole it, then back water, and allow the enemy ship to flood. They were very much like the Athenian navy of the Peloponnesian War. Better crews, sophisticated tactics. The Romans were not interested in doing that because they felt themselves to be at a disadvantage when it came to rowing. Their oarsmen simply were not as good. Their strength lay in the marines that they put on their ships, who themselves would have been heavy and encumbering on their ship, making it more sluggish. And the idea that the Romans had was that they would go straight at the enemy, try and hit them in the prow, drop the ship, the boarding bridge down, and fight a boarding action, which was very successful for them.
But then isn't the ship that gets captured at the start of the war, the Carthaginian ship that runs aground, isn't that a cataphract ship? So wouldn't that have been carrying troops as well?
I would agree that they definitely would have had marines on it. It seems, though, that the Carthaginians did not put as many marines aboard their ships. These would all have been mercenaries, in any case, as the Romans did. The Romans, under normal circumstances, had 40 marines on their quinquiremes, but when battle was anticipated that they were going out to fight, they knew they were going to meet the Carthaginian fleet, they would have 120 marines on board, which is an extraordinary number. And they probably overwhelmed the Carthaginian opposition, both by perhaps ferocity, but especially by numbers. And the boarding bridge allowed them to deliver these marines very rapidly. I can imagine the Romans rushed aboard, and the Carthaginian marines found themselves overwhelmed.
Presumably they're capturing Carthaginian ships as well. So is it at Economus where they captured around 60 ships?
That 64,
Instantly gives Rome a big boost in its navy, and perhaps that those continual capturing of ships changed the way that they worked, so they didn't necessarily need the Corvus as they learned, as they went on and got ships of a slightly different design and quality.
It's difficult to say because the sources don't say whether or not captured Carthaginian vessels were ever incorporated into the Roman fleet.
The seven, the one that's captured at
Mylae, right?
Mylae, yeah.
Right. They did take a gigantic seven at Mylae, but I don't know when you talk about standard quinquiremes, what was incorporated into the Roman fleet or what they were doing, and the differences between, see, Polybius states quite adamantly that the Roman quinquiremes were copied from Carthaginian models, a Carthaginian model, but for whatever reason, they were more sluggish and heavier in their operation. But what the differences would have been between the Roman version of the Carthaginian galley and the Carthaginian galley itself, it can only be guessed at. I can only imagine that perhaps the fit and finish wasn't as good, but the Romans also had many more Marines on board, so presumably it would have been slower. Okay, with each man would have been additional weight. It might have affected the maneuverability of the quinquereme. Possibly that was what made the Corvus attractive. If the Romans wanted to fight a battle at sea and they were going to be carrying more Marines, then anything that would have made their ability to get their soldiers onto the deck of an enemy warship would have been welcome, even if it was an additional weight to their quinquereme, which was already sluggish.
You might not actually have any evidence for it as well, but you'd think that throughout the war, the Romans are going to be getting, you know, either assistance or advice or ideas from, you know, Syracusan ships or the Tarentine ships as well. And, I mean, when them just identifying, you know, saying Romans take up the Carthaginian design, there must be, you know, other, whether the Syracusans and the Trentines and whatnot are using other designs there as well, that might be influencing Roman building tactics.
It's an attractive theory to say that Sicilian, Greek, possibly Syracusan naval architects had come forward with an idea to help the Romans. Modern commentators have suggested that it was a Sicilian Greek who had come up with the idea of the Corvus in the first place. But the historicity of that is there's no way to prove that. The source just seems to say that, at least from Polybius, that the Roman fleet put in Sicily somewhere, someone suggested to them to put this Corvus on their decks, and they did so, and then they took it out and fought the Battle of Mylae in 260 and were successful. It's an attractive theory. It just can't be proved on the basis of the limited sources that we have.
How much are the sources writing for the victors for Rome? Is it some sort of propaganda thing that might also be dressing up the idea?
I don't know. I think that we have to remember that Polybius, he's writing, I want to say, 110 years after this boarding bridge was developed and, you know, put into effect. I'm not certain what kind of information he may have had available to him. It just seems that it was important to Polybius to say they adopted the Corvus and used it with great success, but it was not important enough for him to explain much more about its operation or what eventually happened to it. That's just not what his history was about.
Did all this shipbuilding have any effect on the two economies? I mean, usually, you know, at times of war, technology jumps forwards. I mean, in shipbuilding, and it's a huge undertaking, high cost items. How did it affect the two nations? Did it bleed them dry, or did it make them?
At the end of the war in 242, the Romans decided to make one last bid for control of the sea. And the Roman treasury, they were flat broke. And what they tried, the solution that they hit upon to pay for their final fleet of 200 quinqueremes, which was itself, each of these were going to be based on another captured Carthaginian vessel, was private subscription. That is, individual Roman citizens, private citizens, would either pay for a quinquereme on his own, or a consortium of Roman citizens would band together to pay for a quinquereme, and the only compensation that they were going to receive was whatever booty was taken. And that was how the fleet that fought the decisive battle of the Aegetes Islands in 241 was paid for. It was this private subscription model.
It's exactly the same as the English in World War II as well.
I was going to say American war bonds in the Second World War.
Interestingly, the question of finance is a tricky one, because economic data from the ancient world it's non-existent for the most part. The ancients, they didn't have this concept of a funded debt. It seems that the idea of floating bonds was first practiced effectively by the British government to fight the Napoleonic Wars. All right, the idea that you would have a bond and then it would the money would be repaid at a later date with some sort of interest. For the Romans, money was money. It was coins or some sort of precious metal that could function in place of money, and it was very hard to come by. It seems that the wealth may have existed still in the hands of private citizens, but the state had difficulty getting its hands on it. Many centuries later, we have this extraordinary example where the Emperor Marcus Aurelius in the 160s is auctioning off furniture from the imperial palace to pay for his own wars. The Roman Empire in the second century obviously had massive amounts of wealth, but it was not available to the Roman government to use in the form of currency to pay for its soldiers and the like.
What about the victory monument that was put up in the Forum dedicated to Scipio? Was it Scipio? No, wait a sec, I'm getting this wrong.
Caius Duilius, possibly?
Julius, sorry, yes. On that, there's supposed to be a reference to coin, the amount of, you know, basically the bougie that comes from that victory in particular, and it refers to the amount of coinage that actually came from both the captured vessels and the what was made from slaves captured during the battle and sold off and whatnot that was then fed back into the state coffers.
And wasn't the main element of the monument was actually the prows of captured ships, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I think
this is on the column.
To answer what happened to captured ships, you know, you can't just man 60 captured ships. You need several thousand people from nowhere. But I think, you know, they probably were, if they couldn't be used, they would have been broken down for either parts, or certainly the prows would have gone to the monument.
Well, if it's anything like when the Romans captured the elephants that they captured during the First Punic War. I mean, they're not used in a military sense. They're just sold off for entertainment's sake. I don't know if they're, you know, the Romans are at that time quite into the recycling of other people's war wares.
Their crews wouldn't have come over, pressed into service.
No.
But there was a distinction between praedia and spolia, wasn't there? So, for example, a ship might not be considered to be a spoil, but it would be considered to be something that could be sold to, converted into ready cash and then use that for a monument, like you've described, or a temple or something like that. But, you know, for example, the general's panoply might have been the spoils, which would have been venerated and put in a temple and given to Jupiter Fratricius, for example.
Mm. You know, and I think that, you know, the gladiatorial combat dates from around 264, doesn't it, in terms of having prisoners of war put to death for honouring the dead Romans and, you know, as a sacrifice to the gods. So, no one would have survived even if they were captured, I think.
There is the exchange of prisoners as well, though. So prisoners are being kept long enough to, you know, later be exchanged back.
Right.
So it's not an immediate reaction of, you know, they're captured, let's get rid of them. There is a delay there for a process to take place.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine some prisoners were also held for hostage.
Mm.
For ransom, I guess.
Yeah. At least upper class.
Yeah, exactly. If you capture a rival captain or admiral or something, you would hold them for ransom. That's one way to get money in ancient times, for sure.
And I mean, what we do know of the political system, the Barkid family obviously is very powerful, but not the only Carthaginian family. So, capturing a member of a prominent family would presumably be obvious, and therefore, a source of income. Not much changes in a few thousand years of warfare, really.
No. Asinus is taken captive and then bartered back, so...
I was going to move on to the land, and unless anyone have any other thoughts about naval warfare. I was going to say, how do the two shape up against one another on land?
Well, the Carthaginian army, in terms of Carthaginian citizen soldiers, seem to be usually reserved for defending home territory, and then forces sent out for example Sicily seem to be mainly taken from mercenaries from the Iberian Peninsula, Africa, and there's reference to the Italians as well.
But does that put them at a disadvantage using mercenaries over Roman citizen soldiers?
They're all fighting in a foreign land. So, I mean, the Romans are fighting away from home. The mercenaries are obviously fighting away from home. Nobody's really defending their home ground.
No, but the Roman citizen soldiers are fighting for themselves, not for a third party, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I was trying to get at. Does the fact that you're using citizen soldiers help build the idea of Rome and the Roman army and esprit de corps, whereas...
The Roman army at this time, really, isn't it just a seasonal phenomenon? It comes together to campaign under its two praetors or consuls, and at the end of the season it goes back home to till the fields. So we're not talking a professional army at this point. And that's the big disadvantage compared to the Carthaginians hiring professional, presumably, soldiers. I mean, they are paid for results. They're pretty brutal, and they know the stakes. But the Roman soldier turns up with his arms and armor on the field of Mars and swears the oath, and off he goes with his commanders and hopes to come back at the end of the season.
Okay, that throws my argument out.
Sorry.
The analogous argument, of course, is with the success of Hannibal, again, using mainly mercenaries, is that he has an incredible army that's forged through success and time in the field shared into an amazing fighting force, even though it is a polyglot army. According to tradition, he learned everything he could from his uncles and father and things. Yeah, I think a mercenary army can absolutely have an esprit de corps that rivals a citizen army, and it has those advantages that Lindsay mentioned. So
I think it's much more influential that instead of looking at whether it's a citizen army or a mercenary army, I think it's how the different sides react during this war to success and failure. I mean, the Romans seem to be a little bit more positive about success and failure than the Carthaginians. The Carthaginians have this horrible knack of, you know, executing an unsuccessful leader. The Romans, on the other hand, might just say, no, you're not going to get a triumph this time. But then the Romans are, you know, or seem to be much more forthcoming in saying, when there is a great victory, we're going to, you know, do a big hoo-ha about it. And there's a huge number of triumphs being given out to successful generals coming back at the end of each season. So maybe it's that the Romans have got, you know, they might not have as professional an army, but they might be, you know, bolstering the army that they do send out with a little bit more morale than the Carthaginians have.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I was more sort of, it was in my mind that you're fighting for, well, might not have been at the time, but the idea for a greater Rome, and that perhaps later on looking back, it's the kind of thing that galvanizes society, like the whole neocon thing, you know, we need a war to pull people together and we all fight together.
Also, we don't know how many of it, in terms of the Roman army, we don't know exactly the makeup of how much influence the newly made allies are having on the Roman army at this stage either, I don't think.
See, that was another thing, if you could get... Because at this time they've just taken, they're still in fledgling, they've taken over the peninsula. I was just sort of thinking, well, maybe it's a way of pulling up, everyone pulling together to say, I'm Roman and you're part of the machine, rather than if you're all using mercenaries, it's not necessarily, you haven't got an invested thing from your homeland or what is your calling homeland.
If you're hinting at, for example, it enables the Romans to kind of pull together their neighbours and create a sort of Roman-Italian identity. What's surprising to me with the research I'm doing right now is even down to Augustus, part of the reason for the writing of the Aeneid, for example, was that the identity of an Italian, in a sense as Roman, was still not very well accepted. Campanians were Campanians. Etruscans were sort of Etruscan in terms of their association and love for their land. They didn't feel particular love for the people in the Latin part of the root of Italy, as it were. So I think it would have been a case of appealing to treaty negotiations, your allies, you're with us, we're going on Tuesday, you better be there type of deal. And if they didn't show up, they were in violation of the treaty and there were consequences.
The other thing that that stood out to me was that the Rome actually does invade North Africa. They put sandals on the ground in North Africa and actually went for Carthage itself. Do you think they expected that? Did they think that the fighting would be on Sicily and at sea, and instead Rome, because they seem to,
they don't seem to have anticipated going full on in Sicily in the first place. They seem to have sort of started out looking for a toehold in Sicily, and then when that's gone well, they've sort of moved to the next step of taking on Syracuse, because that's just seemed to have been the right thing to do at the time. Then they've sort of moved to the, a couple of successes later, they realised that they might actually have a chance of getting Carthage out of Sicily altogether, and then once that's actually been achieved, maybe even going one step further and jumping across the pond to Africa. It does seem to sort of have a ricocheting effect one after the other, rather than a planned,
It doesn't sound like they have a grand strategy, does it? Mm. It's an incremental, we won, so let's try this.
But it's not we've won, there you go, boys, it's, we've won, right, let's go for the, the head of the snake kind of thing. There's no messing about. There's no, let's build a fleet and we'll carry on grinding them down in the sea. It's just, let's just go over there and, take out the top.
One of the criticisms of Roman strategy during the First Punic War is that they lost focus on what would have brought them victory in Sicily, which was the reduction of the last few remaining Carthaginian strongholds at Lilybaeum and Drepana, and instead embarked upon a full-scale invasion of Africa in 256 in the aftermath of their great naval victory at Ecnomus. The odd thing that the Romans did when they landed in North Africa was that they immediately recalled most of their army, and left a force of just 15,500 troops to take on Carthage's forces in North Africa. Presumably, they thought maybe that they were going to have an easier time of it. I think also it reflects that it was very difficult for the Romans to, if you go by the Polybius's figures, the Romans may have had as many as 140,000 sailors and marines in the fleet at Ecnomus. I think it was impossible for them to sustain that sort of maximum effort for very long, and they left a relatively small force in North Africa. Marcus Atilius Regulus had the Carthaginians on the ropes. The Carthaginians came out to negotiate with him and said, we want terms. But the terms that Regulus proposed were so harsh that the Carthaginians said, we'll go down fighting and die fighting. And they then hired Xanthippus, the Spartan mercenary officer, who managed to whip their army into shape, gave them confidence. And in the resulting battle, somewhere around Tunis, the Carthaginians defeated Regulus's Roman army. Regulus is captured, and the war continues. Obviously, as I mentioned, the criticism is that if the Romans had simply used their power to reduce Lilybaeum and Drepana instead of frittering away their effort in North Africa, they might have gained better results faster. That's the road not taken.
Mm. They also seem not to have actually been thinking about long-term strategy in terms of, if you look at some of their successes that they have, like at Agrigentum, where after their success, they then go and, either sell them all into slavery or, kill any captives and whatnot. They're not really creating any friends in Sicily as they're going along. They're not thinking, we're settling this as a province as such.
That comes back to that idea, like we mentioned before, of mission creep in the first instance, but also that idea of there being, is there a Roman grand strategy? And there, there's clear evidence that there isn't. But at the same time, a lot of those ideas that they lose sight of the big picture is, A, they didn't have one, but B, because you've got individual Roman commanders vying with one another for gloria, you're going to have someone do something which is completely unbeneficial to the war aims, if there were such things, because they want glory themselves. So there isn't this sort of systematic destruction of and reduction of Carthaginian held towns. There are these sort of out of left field things, because an individual commander says, right, well, I'm going to go and get all the glory myself. And, you know, like with the abandonment of, a small number of men in North Africa, because either the colleague or someone else at Rome says, yeah, no, you're not going to get it, I'm going to take it off you, which is, of course, one of the major disadvantages of the Roman system when they're not all pulling in the same direction, if we can use a naval metaphor.
There's also the, in terms of going for the triumphs, there doesn't seem to be a consistent, you know, this is what classifies as a triumph in terms of actually saying there's a grand strategy back home either. It's very wishy-washy in terms of politics, who's going to get it, who they're going to give a triumph to and on what basis.
Well, ultimately, Rome, the Res Publica, is the triumph of the well-intentioned amateur, isn't it? I mean, it's competition amongst people to look, I'm the guy and I get the chance to thump my chest, and next year it'll be someone else's go. And the reason why there's no grand strategy is there can't be one man in command. Unless there's a dictator, which I don't recall there being during this period, it's always going to be at least two men and probably a committee. Like Murray said, I mean, once you get them into the field, there's effectively no practical means to communicate with each other. You are on your own. You know, you have your imperium to go do your mission, and your job is to win.
So why did they win?
Because staying power. They didn't give up.
Yeah, the sheer force of will.
Mm.
We've touched upon it before in other podcasts as well about the Roman tenacity to just keep going and going, where other people might just say, you know what, maybe this is not the right course of action. And also the amount of manpower that they seem to be able to field in any engagement is staggering.
I think what the other thing we were just talking about, you know, if you're a Roman commander and you're succeeding a successful Roman commander, you're naturally wanting to be more successful. So that's going to perpetuate conquest, whereas, you know, there's that problem after the Second Punic War of, well, no one's going to be as good as you ever. What are we going to do? And they go and looking for more wars to fight, falsely advertise their achievements as being as great as the previous commanders of a previous generation, because they have to. There's no point in saying, well, none of us are ever going to be as good as Scipio Africanus, therefore let's not bother. They go and conquer somewhere smaller, less significant, and go, I am as great as Africanus because I have conquered this town. And the same thing with the triumphs. You know, they're giving triumphs out for lesser conquests further down the track, because otherwise no one would ever achieve a conquest. No one would ever achieve a triumph again. So I think that's the perpetuation of Roman warfare is also about the nature of competition between the Roman generals, is that, mm-hmm. you know, next year I'm going to go and fight, but there won't be a war to fight. Well, doesn't matter. I'm going to go and fight. So I think that also is part of the tenacity and
there's
the manpower.
The Carthaginians also, on the same hand, don't want to end up like some of their previous commanders. You don't want to be another Hanno or another Hanno in terms of going back and finding the equivalent of the senators deciding that they're going to crucify you because you lost a battle, or you made the wrong decision because you didn't go to the help of Hannibal in Agrigentum and in as swift or as an efficient a way as possible. So maybe that's just holding them back and saying, you know, we don't want to risk it.
So in total, it sounds like that you could summarize as that Roman tolerance for defeat was broader than the tolerance of the other side. And as long as they could keep matching and replenishing with resources and so forth, they could always show up for another battle. In a sense, it's a good bit, like the Soviets in the Second World War. You know, the fact is they could keep retreating back, but as long as in the end they were the ones still standing with a weapon in their hand, they were the winners, and that's what counted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think at the risk of sounding flippant, but I've never bothered with that. They have a really good subs bench in Rome. That, you know, if you lose your frontline players, you've got a whole pile of semi-trained and quite talented, possibly, people sitting waiting to take their place. I think
the Carthaginians are just a bit like the English rugby and the English cricket team. They want to get rid of their coaches immediately.
Yeah, and kill them. You know, it's not like, you know, you've got nothing to offer us. So it'd be very interesting to fight to play a sports tournament like the First Punic War. It would be hilarious. Yes. You die. I'm putting you to death. You failed. You didn't score the penalty. You're gone.
So when peace is finally achieved, did it solve anything? I mean, there's another, or is it just breathing space?
Clearly not, because there were two more wars.
I think the Romans may have expected it to be more final than it was. I think the recovery of Carthage after the First Punic War is remarkably fast. You know, the speed with which Rome, with Carthage recovers itself, shocks even them. I think, which leads obviously to the renewed conflict and then the Second Punic War, especially.
Well, it's so it's what Roman warfare is all about: bring home the decisive win, not going to the negotiating table and whatnot. And at the same time, the demands they put on Carthage in terms of the paying back of what amounts to basically what classical Athens made every year in their entire income. They were trying to cripple Carthage right down to the ground, and at the same time, you've got Carthage having to deal with other issues in the African hinterland and whatnot, and for Carthage to come back, it is an amazing feat.
Yep, and I think the other thing is, of course, that Roman attitude of "How dare you? You were defeated." Mm. For Carthage to come back is almost an insult to the decisive victory that Rome achieved against it. Just that great chagrin that Romans have. How dare you?
Yeah, like that line from Gladiator, isn't it? They should know when they're defeated.
Well, perhaps we should leave it there. I'd like to thank Joshua, Murray, Lindsay, Mark, and Mark. Don't forget, for more information on the magazine, go to ancient-warfare.com. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.